to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. I caught up with Bio member and oral historian Allison Owings on July 31st, 2025 on Zoom. She has written four books. Her latest biography, Mayor of the Tenderloin, Del Seymour's Journey from Living on the Streets to Fighting Homelessness in San Francisco, was published in September 2024 by Beacon Press. It was released in paperback in September 2025. You spent nearly a decade interviewing Del Seymour. What was the evolution of that relationship, and how did the quality and depth of what he shared change over time?
We started actually somewhat slowly in that I did not know too much about his life at all, other than that he'd been homeless. I was frankly startled at how candid he was, and candor is a mark of Del Seymour. The more we talked, I believe that he trusted me more and more and was open about certain aspects of his life that he really didn't want to talk about. In fact, to this day, I'm not sure what his motive was in being so candid with me. It could be that he was trying to be helpful. It could be that he was exorcising some demons in his own life. It could be that he was hoping to help other people if and when my book ever got published. Or there could be another reason, I don't know. He was very generous with his time. I was never sure whether what he was telling me was the factual truth, in that he spoke a lot in hyperbole and exaggeration, and often would say that his addiction to crack did not help his memory. But I always believed that the core of what he said was true. I also thought he was withholding a lot, especially his relationship with women. But I don't know. One reason the book took so long was not simply those years of interviews, but trying to find an agent and then trying to find a publisher. So had I had an agent and a publisher at the ready, instead of the book taking 9 years, I might only have taken eight. It was still a very long process.
Got it. Did you ever feel like you were walking a tightrope between journalistic honesty and being loyal to your subject?
No, I always felt that I was being honest with him, asking him what he had to say. I was meticulous in making sure the interviews were transcribed correctly, so that even though what he said might be a little questionable, I at least got the quotes correct. Because I'm trained as a journalist and take it very seriously, I wanted to make sure that I didn't exaggerate or edit or put in my opinions at all. In fact, this is the first of my oral history books in which I am not in the pages after the preface.
So why did you make that choice?
Well, there were two reasons. One, somewhat embarrassing, is that somebody on Goodreads once wrote about my book, my last book, Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans. He said it should be called Listening to Allison Owings Listen to Native Americans. In other words, I seem to be in it quite a bit. And I was in it, and I was in my other books as well, in part for particular reasons of reacting to some of these communities that were stereotyped. But that really stung a bit, and I thought, oh, maybe I'm in it too much, although I don't think I would have changed anything in those books. But with this book, with Del Seymour, I thought, I'm focusing on one person, a person who has a completely different background from mine, an African-American who had been homeless and addicted. It's not as if we're walking down the same road together. And literally, when we walked down the same street together, I just took myself off that street in writing. I thought, this is his book. This is his story. And actually, I interviewed about 15 other people who are in the book, too. But there are certain I may say even clever ways that I got myself out of it, just for instance, by asking a question and not putting quotation marks around it. I would say maybe asked how he dealt with this or this or this, he said something like that. There were ways to get yourself out of the story. And I felt obligated not to try to share the stage with him.
That kind of gets me to the question of why did you want to tell Del Seymour's story? What was the motive behind this book and also in taking yourself out of it? How did that help you tell the story better?
Initially, I wanted to do a book that was like my other books in that I would interview a wide range of people on the particular subject, whether it was German women in the Third Reich or American waitresses or Native Americans. And I was picturing going all over the country interviewing homeless people, or as the politically correct phrase these days is people experiencing homelessness, which I understand. And I thought, not only did it sound exhausting and difficult to research and difficult to use my usual techniques of follow-up questions, but I also thought, who would want to read this book that has nothing but unhappy endings? Who would want to publish it? I had to think in those terms a little bit. I would not necessarily want to read a book that had nothing but unhappy endings. And then I met Dell, and as I explained in the preface, I had no idea he had been homeless. He was leading a Tenderloin walking tour, which is an enterprise he started in order to earn some legitimate money, not much money, but legitimate money rather than selling dope.
But I'm going to interject here. What made you sign up for that walking tour?
Oh, I signed up for the walking tour because my husband and I knew a man who was a playwright in the Tenderloin whose play was being produced by a Tenderloin theater. And so, of course, we bought tickets to support our friend. And the theater announced there would be a Tenderloin walking tour before the start of the play for anyone who wanted to sign up. And it would cost $15 a person. It could be interesting. And it was a matinee, so it was a safe time of day to be in the Tenderloin. Sometimes nights are a little sketchier. Often nights are a little sketchier. So we signed up. And it was Dell leading the tour. So it had nothing to do with anything other than supporting our friend who was the playwright. And then on this tour, Dell, who had said he'd been an addict, which was pretty clear because he was talking about that, and that was partly the subject of the play too. He then said this sentence that just riveted me. It's the sort of sentence that rivets anyone. Like you, Jenny, as an oral historian, our ears are just peaked and ready for an interesting sentence.
Yes.
And Dell said he was pointing to part of an intersection in the Tenderloin, and he said, "I could have gotten a PhD in sidewalks." And I thought, a PhD in sidewalks, that had so much pathos in it.
Yeah, that's legit.
And it told me he'd been homeless, which I hadn't known. Because many drug addicts are not homeless, as well as many homeless people are not drug addicts. But it told me he'd been homeless. And I thought, oh, as he kept talking and we kept walking, I thought, maybe I can just do a book focused on one person's experience rather than go all over the country and find other homeless people. So that's how it started, quite inadvertently.
Wow. I want to come back to the idea that you weren't always sure if he was telling the truth or if he was exaggerating. When you have conflicting versions of the same event from different interview sessions, how do you decide what makes it into the book?
His responses were pretty much the same. There could be a difference in terms of what year something took place or his opinion about it, but there was really thematically a consistency. So I wasn't faced with a situation where he'd say, "I never went to jail," or "I often went to jail." He was really quite consistent in the main in what he said. And as I said, I did trust him. I mean, he enjoys telling a story. And I know he still exaggerates. And when we do appearances now, he's now taken to shaving a year off his age. And at first, at one appearance, I said, "No, Dell, you're not 77, you're 78." And he was entirely annoyed and said, "Thanks for reminding me." So I shut up about that from now on. But I didn't really find that there were a lot of factual inconsistencies that made me wonder what is true, what is not true. It made me, in a way, appreciate the gradations of the story.
Some of the themes in this book, it seems like you must have conjured up some difficult memories in not just Dell's life, but some of the oral histories that you collected. And I wonder, what techniques do you use to help people access these difficult memories, especially the traumatic ones?
That's a good question. I guess I try to be as low key as I can be. I never start off with the hardest questions. For instance, when I was interviewing elderly German women about the Third Reich, I would not start off by saying, "What did you know about Auschwitz?" I would start by asking about their childhood and what their parents did for a living, which gave me sometimes a clue as to their political beliefs. And then we'd kind of work our way into the more difficult subjects. And sometimes with Dell, he almost didn't need any prompting. The exception was when I learned he had been a pimp. I knew that I had to ask him about that. And I knew he did not want to talk about it. In fact, he did not want to talk about it so much that we left the Tenderloin and went to the house where he was living at the time and arranged a special session. And he literally closed the windows on one side of the house where there were people who spoke English nearby, and he didn't want them to hear. But he said the Mexican side is okay because they wouldn't necessarily know what he was saying. And he was a different person talking about having been a pimp. He was very uncomfortable. He didn't like talking about it. He also asked, "Why do we have to talk about this?" And I essentially said, "It's part of your story. And as part of your journey to make things right, especially for young African American women who were the women he pimped." That was unusual. And I think made him very uncomfortable. And it happened shortly after we met. I think I started interviewing him in December of 2015. And this was just maybe in February or March the next year. And I never would have done it had I known the book would take so long. I would have waited a couple of years until he knew me better, felt a little more comfortable around me. Instead, I think I came across as someone who was probing impolitely into things he didn't want to talk about. And I'm still not sure why he answered. I think he was trying to be helpful and maybe dealing with his own demons. I don't know.
Fascinating. Yeah, you kind of grapple with that on the page a little bit. That might have been a really difficult place in the book for you to extract yourself and really just talk about it, frankly. But you interviewed 15 to 20 people for this book. And I'm curious how you organize and store the mountains of recorded material from, all of these interviews. What's your system of archiving these oral histories? Do you keep the original recordings indefinitely, or how do you handle these ethical questions around preserving versus protecting these intimate stories?
Wow, this is the first book which consists of no physical evidence per se, such as a CD or a cassette tape. So everything's on my phone or some kind of recording device. I'm not the most organized person, unfortunately. I could really use a full-time assistant. I'm so disorganized. But the interviews are there on my computer, many on my phone, and I frankly haven't decided what to do with them. Library institutions have bought the archives of my other books, and I think that would be likely with this book, except, as I said, these are just still on my phone. Initially, I would have them transcribed by someone I would hire, some I would transcribe myself. Sometimes I'd have a machine transcribe them, and then I would double check that the transcription was correct. And I never really have thought about preserving it or not preserving it. When Dell would say, "Don't put this in the book," I would not put it in the book, but I wouldn't erase it. I would just have it. And I don't know that I haven't decided what I would do with something like that. There weren't many of those occasions. And the other people did not put any limitations on what they said to me. Dell rarely did. I think it was mostly really to protect somebody else, not him. So I just obediently didn't put whatever it was in the book and then went on. But as I say, it still exists. And I haven't decided what I'm going to do with the archival material for it. Does that answer your question, though?
It absolutely does. It kind of opens up another question that I have about the things that are said off the record. I find to be even more fascinating. Like, why are they asking to turn off the tapes? Why are they asking to not put this in the book? Those are some of the more interesting things, the things that people intentionally want to omit. But that's another conversation. I think that's an essay for some periodical as an oral historian. If you're going to archive this stuff with a library, you might have to take some of those omissions out. But, these things are very interesting.
Sometimes I would self-censor without being asked. For instance, there's a family member in Dell's family who is in jail for having abused young women. It's a horrible story. And I know who that person is and how that person is connected to Dell. And I made a decision that that's really nobody's business. He was quite open about it. It was a painful story. It was a painful interview. In fact, I think it had to do with the also painful interview about pimping that basically someone else took it up in his family. But I decided I did not want to say who the relative was because I wanted to protect the other relative involved. So I just kind of wrote around it. And so far, nobody said, "Oh, could that be so and so? Or whose mother or father is that?" And but they haven't asked me. And I felt very good about omitting a detail that could be very, very painful, not only to Dell, but to someone else in his family.
Sure. You mentioned that your editor restructured the book to avoid chronological order. Can you talk to me about finding the right rhythm between like up, down, sideways, back in time, that whole thing?
Sure. Actually, the book had three different organizations. The first that I did was chronological because Dell told me so much. It was very difficult to keep it all straight. So I thought, start at the beginning. He's born in Chicago. And then my agent said, "You're asking a lot of people to read 200 pages before this guy's life takes off in a good way. Do they want to invest all those hours of reading about this terrible stuff that's going on, and then stick with it and knowing that there's going to be a happy ending?" So she restructured it or suggested restructuring. And by then, this is 7 or 8 years into the project, I'm just exhausted. I said, sure. So we got an editor at Beacon Press, which has been wonderful. And the editor said, "There's something with this organization that doesn't quite work." Because the way my agent restructured it, she started with this very upbeat scene where people are graduating from Dell's Code Tenderloin, this organization he started to help disenfranchise people. And it's really upbeat and it's wonderful, and people are shouting and they're tearful and they're so happy. And the editor said, "Yes, it's a wonderful scene, but the reader doesn't yet earn it. The reader has no idea what he's been through to come to this position, to come to this moment." So she restructured the entire book herself again. And now it starts with him going into crack. So it starts way down rather than way up. And there are a few times in her restructuring when I thought maybe this should go here rather than here. I vaguely remember, and I think that was done. But in essence, it's the editor's view. And some people find it a little challenging because it does go up and down and back and forth. But other people find that that syncopation brings you more into his story.
For me, there was a really good flow to it. And there was, enough action that kept me turning the page. It's a really good story. It's a really well-written book. It gave me a lot of food for thought in my oral history project. So, across your four oral history books, from German women to waitresses to Native Americans to Dell, what drew you to stories of people who've been overlooked or stereotyped?
I just thought it was unfair. And I was curious. I've always been curious. I think another word for it could be nosy. But I've always been interested in people who aren't me. And I'd be the last person, for instance, to write a memoir because I don't think I'm very interesting. But I'm really interested in people who did not grow up in Protestant suburban Philadelphia, and which is what I did. Which is why I left, even though I had very interesting parents and siblings. I just wanted to go farther afield. And I had met some of these German women when I was living in southern Spain, actually, trying to write a novel after I left my journalism career at CBS News. And these German women started talking about the Third Reich. And I wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention because I was writing my novel. But I spoke German because I had studied it in high school and college, and I'd actually studied for a year in Germany. So I was relatively fluent, if with sort of an American accent, more than sort of an American accent. And then later, when I returned to the United States, I thought, hold on, these women are talking about the Third Reich. Has anyone ever interviewed them? And I had this thought then, which proved to be completely inaccurate. The German women would be, quote unquote, better than German men. I just thought they'd all be heroines. They'd all be resistance heroines. And that was my hope. This was in about 1984. And I went to Germany, and the first woman I interviewed started talking with great passion about the idealism of National Socialism. And I thought, uh-oh, uh-oh. Well, there goes my whole thesis. And as a journalist, not to mention as an oral historian, which I had only just begun to be, you really have to pivot, be ready to pivot. And I realized my thesis was completely wrong, but I had stumbled onto something that could be much more interesting. So that book took, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. I did three major interview trips to Germany to interview as wide a range of women as I could. These are non-Jewish German women. These are sort of, from an American point of view, the wives of the enemy. But two of the women I interviewed, as it turned out, had Jewish mothers. So they had unique experiences within the Third Reich themselves. But it's really a look at the wives of the enemy and who are these people and how did they get to be the way they are and how do they differ? Because there are some women who are extremely brave and some who to this day, well, none of them is alive anymore, but 40 years after the end of the Third Reich, we're still defending Hitler, which gives me chills that I feel in today's political climate.
Well, I know what I'm reading next. Thank you for sharing that. Where do we
Yeah.
go from here?
Yeah. Yeah, the book really struck a chord, and apparently I was the first person to think of interviewing these women. I got help from a professor at Stanford with whom I had no connection other than knowing that he was a German scholar and I lived nearby. So I interviewed him and asked, has anyone ever interviewed these women? He said, no. And here are some professors' wives to start with, including the woman I just mentioned. So while I was on the road promoting the book, because it got a lot of attention, it was a New York Times notable book of the year. It got lots of attention. While I was on the road, I was by myself often and eating alone, and I started noticing waitresses. And I was wondering, oh, I wonder what their job is like. I mean, I had been a waitress myself, terrible waitress for about 2 weeks, so it wasn't completely a foreign culture. But I started thinking of them more as a group and wondering more about their lives and how they thought about their work. And started thinking about sexism and about classism as it evolved as I talked to them more and more. One of the waitresses I interviewed, because I wanted to get as wide a range as possible, worked on a cafe in the Tohono O'odham Reservation in Arizona. So I started thinking about Native people.
Oh, that's so
And
cool. So there's like a whole thread of your work that kind of
yeah,
flows from one
one
to the
led to the
next.
other.
Wow, that's
Yeah.
fascinating. And collecting oral histories as a social commentary is really an effective way to tell a story. And I like how the evolution of your work has led to a biography of just one person through oral history. It's really fascinating. I hope people go out and buy this book. It's a delicious read, and I think the soft cover is coming out this month.
The soft cover is coming out September 9th.
Great. Well,
Yes.
congratulations and thank you so much.
Thank you, Jenny, and you had great questions.
Thanks. That was my conversation on Zoom with BioMember Allison Owings. Her book, Mayor of the Tenderloin, was published by Beacon Press in September 2024. This interview was recorded on July 31st, 2025. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Sonia Williams is our executive producer. Darren Nesblitt created our theme music. Until next time, thanks for listening.